From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Senator Bernie Sanders has declared for president. The Vermont Independent will try to build on the enthusiasm generated by his 2016 run. But he faces a very different challenge. Instead of an established big-name opponent, he's joining a sea of lesser-knowns. Will he be able to tap into the same online fundraising and grassroots support? We'll debate it next. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. And if you were in the house at the Theater at Ace Hotel for Sunday's 17th Annual Film Week Academy Awards preview, thank you for coming. Boy, that was a fun afternoon. We had, around 1,300 people in the house for that event, and we hope you'll join us. If you missed it, we hope you'll join us for next year's event, and the broadcast will come your way this Friday, 10:30, special early start time for the expanded 90-minute edition of Film Week. It's this Friday, 10:30. You'll hear the entire Oscar preview with our critics. Coming up, in his State of the Union address, President Trump used the term socialism to describe the preferred economic system of Democrats. The president's branding initiatives like single-payer health care and higher taxes, believing that the specter of socialism will deter Americans. Democrats are divided how best to respond. We'll talk about that later this hour. But first, as expected, Bernie Sanders is running again for president. The Vermont Independent Senator is by far the oldest person to ever run for president. If he won, he'd be sworn in at the age of 79. Joe Biden, who hasn't announced, is only a year younger. Well, Sanders addressed questions about his age in an interview this morning with Vermont Public Radio.
I have been very blessed, you know, in my life with good health. And I there are folks out there today who are, 90 years of age, who are working hard. There are folks who are 45 and 50 who are lethargic, don't have a whole lot of energy. I'm very, lucky that as a kid I was a long-distance runner, and I think I have and had and still have a great deal of energy. So I would ask people to look at the totality of who I am, my energy level, my record in the United States Senate, and not just at one criteria.
Sanders also urged Democrats to go beyond identity politics.
We have got to look at candidates, not by the color of their skin, not by their sexual orientation or their gender, and not by their age. I mean, I think we have got to try to move us toward a non-discriminatory society which looks at people based on their abilities, based on what they stand for.
Bernie Sanders in announcing his candidacy for president this morning in Vermont. Joining us to talk about the Sanders candidacy is Occidental College Associate Professor of Politics, Caroline Heldman, author of Protest Politics in the Marketplace, Consumer Activism in the Corporate Age. Professor Heldman, good to have you with us again.
Good to be here, Larry. Thank you.
So let's start with Senator Sanders' candidacy. He so captured lightning in a bottle back in 2016 with tremendous success, raising funds online, grassroots enthusiasm and rallies around the country. Couldn't get over the hurdle of Hillary Clinton's candidacy, but nonetheless came out of nowhere to be a very strong contender. Can he recapture that magic?
I think it will be more difficult for him this time around. I do think that he will have a more difficult time in a crowded field, especially with candidates who look somewhat like him policy-wise. So, for example, Elizabeth Warren. But his biggest contribution to American politics has been moving it to the left. I actually credit him with the rise of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other candidates who identify as democratic socialists who have actually gotten elected to Congress. So I don't think Bernie will do as well this time simply because the field has so many Bernie Sanders-like candidates, but he's already made a mark in American politics.
Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, joining us as well. Sean, good morning. Do you think Sanders is going to find this a much rougher road than last time?
Oh, I do think he's going to find a definitely rougher road, and I think a lot of the Bernie bros are probably going to
Sean, you're just a little off mic there. If we can just,
how's that, Larry?
Yeah, that's better. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. I think a lot of the Bernie bros are going to gravitate towards other candidates, as Dr. Heldman said, to an Elizabeth Warren or some of the more left. He's no longer the left of the left. The question is he going to run even left, more left in this primary or stay to where he was? So it's going to be interesting. I will tell you, I do think there are so many candidates out there that are running so far to the left. If a Joe Biden gets into the race, if a John Kerry gets into the race, if a Eric Holder gets into the race, they look like they're the more moderate, conventional conservative Democrats.
What about what Sanders said in that interview this morning about identity politics, saying Democrats shouldn't be looking at the age, the race or ethnicity, the sexual identity of a candidate? Your thoughts on that message, Sean, within the party?
I think that's the, hey, don't look at me as the old white guy who's beyond his shelf life. Senator Harris and Senator Warren, Senator Klobuchar, and some of the other women that are running in the race, some of the people of color that are running in the race, really cut into what was his base in the past. So he has to say that, I think, to try and buttress up why his campaign can be relevant. It's not just ideologically speaking, but Democrats are running very heavily on having more minorities involved in politics, more women involved in politics, and he's not that person.
Professor Heldman, your thoughts about what he said about race, ethnicity, age, and sexuality?
I agree with Sean that he is trying to be relevant in a field that is much more diverse than he is at this point. But I also worry that he, you know, using the term identity politics and being critical of it in some way reflects that he doesn't quite understand what that term means and what it means to the left. Identity politics simply means that our various identities have meaning and shape our political beliefs, and also that it shapes what we get out of politics, where the resources are allocated. So for Bernie to be going after identity politics in some sense indicates that he doesn't know his base very well.
We're talking with Caroline Heldman, Occidental College professor, Sean Walsh of Wilson Walsh Consulting in San Francisco. Also, this weekend, yesterday, Elizabeth Warren was in Glendale, the Massachusetts senator, holding a sold-out event at the Alex Theater in Glendale, where she unveiled a fully paid government child care plan as a part of her economic platform. Caroline, your thoughts on Elizabeth Warren, and how is she going to differentiate herself from the other progressive candidates who are a bit newer to this?
I think that she's made a name for herself going after corporate abuse and exploitation. I think she's probably in California because we've moved up our primary to actually be competitive this year. So instead of Iowa and New Hampshire, states that are 90% white, determining who the primary contenders, who will make it out of the early primary states, California and Texas are going to play a role in that. So I would anticipate many candidates coming to California, given the fact that we've now become a competitive state in the primary process.
Sean, how do you see this playing out with fundraising for Democrats, with so many announced candidates and others expected to enter the field soon? How is this going to slice and dice the major donors on the Democratic side?
Well, I think Dr. Heldman's right. Again, I will tell you, California historically has been the ATM for most campaigns. And because our primary happens late in the process, we generally aren't that relevant. So this time out, we are relevant from a cash perspective, and we're relevant from a prioritization in the electoral process. And because I looked at the New York Times coming in here this morning, their webpage, there's potentially 28 candidates that are hovering about that will be running in this primary. So I don't think this thing's going to be decided in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. I think this thing can go quite a bit of ways into the depth of the primary chart this year. And I will also tell you, Elizabeth Warren, where does she fit? Senator Harris fits in certain areas with the people of color and the progressive movement. Senator Warren, in my view, fits in fairly comfortably with the classic more Hollywood progressive liberal crowd who gives a lot of money. I think they like what she had to say. I think they liked a lot of her activities on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau when she helped stand that up and went after Wall Street and Congress. So I think she's got a very strong donor base, particularly in the Hollywood community and with some liberal activists in the San Francisco Bay Area. So if I were just handicapping right now based on the people that are in the race now, she's probably the person that gives the biggest run for the money in California against Senator Harris.
And do those major Democratic donors, do they have less clout than in the past because of Bernie Sanders' candidacy where he showed how much you could raise online? Sean?
Is that to me?
Yeah,
Larry?
Sorry, yeah. Sean.
Well,
yes.
I'm still a believer in that line from The Right Stuff. No bucks, no Buck Rogers. So I think you get your money any way you can. And if people attack you for saying I'm taking big donations from folks, so be it. You still need the bucks to make the thing go. It's going to be interesting to see this time. You've got so many progressive activists out there. How many $10 contributions are they going to get from the various, you know, online groups that are out there? I don't know where that cleaves, to be honest with you right now. I would refer to a Democrat to give you a better idea. But again, no bucks, no Buck Rogers, no campaign. So take it where you can get it.
We're talking with Sean Walsh and Caroline Heldman about the latest political developments. If you want to weigh in with a question or a piece of analysis, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Caroline, does the earlier primary for California, March 3rd of 2020, does that give Kamala Harris a bit of an advantage, given that she's, of course, far better known here than other parts of the country?
I think it gives her an enormous advantage in that it will buoy her star early on. I think if you look at the history of, you know, caucuses in Iowa, Jimmy Carter got a boost, Bill Clinton got a boost. But getting a boost from a state like California, which Senator Harris certainly will, a state that is, you know, the most diverse in the union, will provide a much larger share of the votes needed to win the nomination. I think this really bodes well for her in the state.
All right. Let's also talk about the potential of Joe Biden coming in. Sean, you said earlier you think that the move of the Democratic candidates, almost all of them in a highly progressive direction, opens up the door for Joe Biden. But, you know, he's talked much more as a progressive over the last 2 years than he ever did as vice president or prior to that as a senator. So what's your sense of whether he himself has shifted?
Well, I go back to the Nixon axiom, which is, again, you run to the right if you're a Republican in a primary and you run to the left as a Democrat in a primary, and then you go back to the center in a general. So I think Biden's history in the United States Senate, his history being a little bit more moderate, actually, than Obama was in his administration, the positive glow still from the Obama administration, unfair, I think, quite candidly, but there's still a lot of people who very fondly remember the Obama administration. So I think he's got an enormous advantage and an enormous pedestal in which he can stand on that most of the other candidates don't have. So if you've got literally 15 to 20 candidates running really, really far to the left, you throw a little bit of left rhetoric in, but you do the mainstream stuff, you get the unions to be happy with you, and you've got yourself a pretty good platform going all the way through the primary process.
Surfcraft writes on the AirTalk page, I'm glad Bernie Sanders has thrown his hat back into the ring, if for no other reason than to provide some ballast to the young cadre of progressives. Julie H. writes, his age really is a concern for me. He'd be in his 80s through most of his first term if he won. Is he thinking of running as a one-term president? Age is a big issue. As I mentioned, he's by far the oldest candidate to ever run for president, several years older than Ronald Reagan was. And Biden would be just a year behind him if he decided to enter. Caroline, your thoughts on the ages of those two and how prominent that would be in the campaigns?
Well, I would hope it wouldn't be prominent only because the people who get to choose whether or not they're too old to run are the candidates themselves. I find that the bent toward ageism in politics, which mostly affects female candidates, but in this case would likely, you know, people would be critical of two male candidates. I don't know what else to call it but ageism, because if the candidates have decided that they have the mental faculties to run and the stamina, and both of them clearly do, then why not?
Sean, your thoughts about age factoring in?
Well, Larry, I've been involved in a number of presidential campaigns. I've stomped through the cornfields of Iowa in the summer and the frozen tundra of New Hampshire in the winter. And the thing I will tell you, I'm not so sure age factors in as much when you're actually the president, but it sure does factor in when you're in a campaign cycle and you've got to go to all these states. Now, if Bernie Sanders is the marathon man, the running, cross-country guy, and he's got the stamina for it, so be it. But it's a real, real test. I think you can already actually see a couple of the candidates. And if you look at their kind of looks on their faces, you already see that tired, I've been out on the hustings for 2 months, and it's already affecting them. So I don't never underestimate the brutality. It's very Darwinian, our election cycle, how long it is, how many states you have to go to, how many different constituencies you have to appeal to. And if you can survive that marathon, and it's a real question whether you can or can't, people make mistakes when they get tired. I think Senator Harris has already actually made a few mistakes, rhetorical mistakes on the trail that possibly because she was tired.
Well, she's only 54, so age is no excuse there, certainly. And Cory Booker's 49. So, I mean, you've got really big age gap between the younger and the older candidates.
You do. You know, my money probably would be on Booker and Harris from a stamina perspective. But if you look at Joe Biden and if you look at Bernie Sanders, they both project a pretty healthy, pretty vigorous image. So, and that's half the battle, too, to be honest with you. How do you project to the general public? You know, you may be a sick and tired old person inside, but if you project externally to the rest of the public in our mass media market today, I think you're fine.
We'll continue with our political analyst. That's Sean Walsh of Wilson Walsh Consulting San Francisco and Occidental College Associate Professor of Politics. Caroline Heldman with us as well. Coming up, we'll talk about the surprise announcement by Amazon last week that they were withdrawing plans to develop a second headquarters in the Queensboro of New York City, what that says about the rise of progressive activism and its effectiveness. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. David in Culver City saying, well, there is a lower age limit for the presidency, got to be 35 to run. Why isn't there an upper age limit for the presidency? You know, I don't know if that would pass constitutional scrutiny for that, although there are some jobs that do have mandatory retirement age if it's a public safety position, for example. I'm not sure if the presidency would qualify for that. We're talking about the very latest in politics. Our guest, Caroline Heldman of Occidental College, Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst based in San Francisco. In a surprising announcement the middle of last week, Amazon said it will not build its so-called HQ2 facility in the Queens borough of New York City. That because of negotiations, which didn't progress with the city after Amazon announced it was going to make this move, and also pushback from progressive activists, including the member of Congress there, who we've talked about, who has really built her profile very short time in Congress in successfully getting attention for her progressive causes. So this is for Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez a significant victory. Caroline Heldman, your thoughts about the Amazon pullout here, and is this emblematic of other sorts of gains you expect progressives to get?
I think it's less about progressive politics in New York and more about how Amazon dropped the ball. So it wasn't just progressive activists who were opposing this. The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal came together and both wrote opinion pieces opposing this deal simply because Amazon didn't really deliver on what they said they would, right? And I'm looking at the deal and it looks like it's pretty good, right? A $27 billion tax revenue expected over two decades. But at the start, they wanted a lot of tax breaks or tax incentives. And the package that they were offering didn't live up to what they had initially advertised. And so they had opposition from all quarters. And I think it's much more a reflection of Amazon dropping the ball on this one than the activism against it.
I thought that after the deal fell apart, the New York Times did come out and was critical of the deal falling apart. But Sean, your thoughts on what the political legs of this might be?
Well, look, it's a private business. It can go anywhere it wants. Tennessee is salivating to say, hey, come on, we were in second place. Come on down. We'll put the welcome mat out for you.
Can you get just a little closer to the mic again? Sorry.
Yeah. So I'm a Republican, so I'm a believer in that tax incentives should be used to motivate businesses and companies to do things that they need to do, number one. And number two, if you're the bodega, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker that's all in and around Brooklyn, you would have benefited tremendously by having that many people and that much money flowing through. Money is a multiplier effect in an economy and has economic benefits. I do think you're starting to see some blowback on de Blasio, and you're certainly seeing blowback on Governor Cuomo. And so whether this hurts the movement for AOC, I don't know. But I will tell you, I just think it was a drop ball on all the political people's parts, because if I've been in government, I've been part of these red teams where they get together and put a package together to try and get companies to go there. At some juncture, you can change the game a little bit. You can increase taxes. There's a lots of things you can do once they're firmly entrenched there. I think they blew it, the Democrat political.
I wonder, Sean, if, you know, there are concerns about gentrification. That's what one hears when you've got major employers like this coming in. And even if it does create thousands of jobs, what the effect is going to be on housing prices, infrastructure, and mom and pop businesses and the like. I mean, does this show that essentially these kinds of deals, particularly with you know, public investment, are going to be much more difficult to put together?
Well, they're difficult for places that don't like gentrification and are happy to have, you know, the traditional inner city blight. There are plenty of cities out there all across this country that would welcome that kind of job investment and welcome that kind of resources. And so, you know, this is an age-old issue. Do you force lower-income people out through gentrification? Does it cost more in housing? Yeah, but the quality of life increases. Taxes go up for schools. A lot of good things happen. If you do good planning, I think you can accommodate gentrification and these types of jobs. And if you do poor planning, you don't. And so that's where the politicians and the elected and government officials' feet should be held to the fire, which is on the, you know, planning and the, you know, out rollout of these things. So like I said, there are plenty of places that will welcome these guys with open arms, and they will be very happy to have those jobs and that money in their communities.
Caroline Heldman, do you think this is going to make it tougher for cities to offer those inducements?
Well, I think, you know, I disagree with Sean somewhat about who benefits, right? So if you have gentrification, the people who are living there now are not likely going to benefit. And I think it signals that if you want to come into a prime location, then you actually have to make sure that you have a plan in place, a contingency plan for people who live there. And I think, for example, LA Live in Los Angeles did a reasonably good job where they require that people who are employed at LA Live live near the site. They took many steps in order to prevent gentrification. So at the end of the day, I think this actually speaks more to how these companies need to come into these spaces and the new considerations that they have to have in place in order to make sure that the people who are there are not just entirely displaced.
Caroline, let's talk about the lawsuits filed by the state's attorneys generals, including Javier Becerra here in California. States filing the lawsuit against President Trump's emergency declaration for the U.S.-Mexico border. Your thoughts on you know, how we're likely to see this play out through the courts?
Well, in the courts, it's going to take probably the better part at the low end of a year, up to many years, because it brings up a question of constitutional authority, right? And technically, the president, of course, has the right to declare a national emergency. By my last count, there are 31 current national emergencies from, you know, preventing the sale of diamonds in the U.S. from Sierra Leone to sanctions against various terrorist groups. But the question is whether or not This strategy can be used to circumvent the legislative process, and that is what Donald Trump has done. He didn't like the fact that Congress didn't fund the wall the way that he wanted it to, and so now he is attempting to pass policy on his own. It sets a dangerous precedent all around, I think, in terms of the Democrats using it for their pet projects as well, the unintended consequences that a lot of Republicans in Congress are also worried about. But through the courts, we're looking at probably the better part of a year at best to make a decision on this.
Sean, how frightened are many Republicans about this for fear it'll backfire with the next Democratic president?
They are very nervous. So people may forget, but when Harry Reid decided to go the nuclear option with regards to judges, the Republicans all said, boy, Harry, I don't think you want to do this, man. Sooner or later, this is going to come back and bite you. And Mitch McConnell specifically went to Harry Reid and says, I really am telling you, you're going to change the rules. You're going to be unhappy. And bam, Republicans take over the Senate and they're ramming Republican judges through the House or excuse me, through the Senate faster than they're moving sausages down the Oscar Mayer Wiener factory. I mean, so be careful what you wish for, because you might just get it. And so Harry Reid and a number of other Republicans actually told Donald Trump, don't do this. Don't do this. You can legally, pretty sure you'll be able to get away with it. You may get some modifications from some federal courts will adjust. But I'm telling you, from a long-term policy perspective, it's bad news. And the Democrats tend to be much more activist when it comes to spending money and doing government activities through executive orders. You know, look at the DACA kids. I mean, Obama used his executive authority. A lot of people thought that that actually was a usurpation of his powers. But he got away with it. So, you know, you can't run a government if you actually really destroy the separations between the three branches.
So at what point do you anticipate the courts are going to say, no, this the president may have this authority on paper and wide latitude, but it's a dangerous precedent to allow? You anticipate courts saying that?
Well, courts could possibly say that, but I doubt that they would, because their role fundamentally is to look at the constitutional questions at the federal court level. And so they do look at precedent. They look at what has happened from the legislative branch and how the executive branch can govern from there. So we've talked about this before. You've got the Secure Fence Act of 2006 that authorized this kind of expenditure in building. You actually had authorization to spend money for this fence in this budget itself. So the argument is that President Trump didn't like how much money went into there, not whether it was authorized. So I think from a legislative authorization perspective, there's not a problem. The question is going to be, can he pull money from one pot and then put money into another pot to do something that he wants to do? That actually happens all the time at the federal government level. So, again, this may be battled. I think it's theatrics by 16 states filing suit. Again, I think it's bad policy. But at the end of the day, I think pretty clearly he's on very solid legal grounds.
Caroline, I want to ask you about the Supreme Court agreeing to fast track the hearing on the census question about citizenship and to whether that's going to depress the participation in the census, and also what the intent of that was by the federal government in asking that question. How important do you think that decision is going to be later this year?
Well, I think it has a lot of symbolic importance. We haven't had a citizenship question on the census since 1950. When Wilbur Ross proposed it, it seemed pretty clear that it was the same part of this rhetoric that Donald Trump has been using about the criminality of Latinx people, right? And it ties in with the border talk, this idea that people who immigrate here need to be removed, that they pose a threat because they have higher rates of criminality, which, of course, the Cato Institute and many other studies from left, right, and center have found are simply not true. So I think it fits the broader narrative of fear and threat of Latinx criminality, which, again, is a myth. And so at the end of the day, it's not a particularly significant question. I know that Democrats and liberal activists are very concerned that it's going to scare Latinx people from filling out the census across the board, whether here legally or not. I haven't seen good evidence of that. There's a possibility that that will happen. But at the end of the day, it's really about why this policy came about. And I would say, you know, the racist symbolism that it embodies.
Sean, quick comment on this. How important you think the high court's decision will be on the question?
Oh, I don't know, Larry. I will tell you, if you ask people today how many people are undocumented in the country, you get estimates of between 11 million and 13 million. You can't figure out how many people that are undocumented that are in our schools and our colleges and in our state. The census is a tool that is used to apportion federal dollars, generally federal dollars, out to the individual states. If you don't know who's here and who's not here, whether you're legal or not legal in the country, those are still resources that a state or a municipality needs to make sure that the people that are living there are covered. So I think it's relatively benign. It's been on the census. My understanding is, and I defer to Dr. Heldman here, but it's been basically a question that's been on the census. It was taken off in the 2010 census, but it's been in some derivation on the censuses prior to that. So I don't think this is the harmful, evil thing that it is. And quite candidly, if you're a Democrat, you actually want this information on there because you want federal dollars to go to your states.
But of course, the concern is whether people would participate, whether they would answer the question honestly or even take part in the census if they're concerned about their status. We'll continue our conversation with Sean Walsh and Professor Caroline Heldman. We'll talk about the term socialism and socialist. President Trump used that term in his State of the Union address. Republicans are looking at that as a possible messaging winner with the American public in how they classify the economic proposals of Democrats. We'll talk about that after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. The Associated Press is reporting that the San Diego Padres have reached the largest free agent baseball deal in history with former Dodgers shortstop Manny Machado. AP reports the Padres are signing Machado to play third base for $300 million over 10 years. That's the biggest free agent contract, if that's confirmed, in baseball history, and the second largest overall behind Giancarlo Stanton's $325 million contract he signed when he was with the Marlins before he was traded to the New York Yankees. So Manny Machado apparently has found a home, and it's right here in Southern California. Wow, that's a lot of money for the Padres to pay for Machado to sign with them. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. Politics, our focus. With us, Professor Caroline Heldman of Occidental College in Eagle Rock, and also with us, Republican political strategist Sean Walsh. They both join us from the Bay Area. Well, in his State of the Union address, President Trump used a term that doesn't poll particularly well with Americans.
Here in the United States, we are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country. America was founded on liberty and independence, and not government coercion, domination, and control. We are born free, and we will stay free. Tonight, we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country.
So the president putting that label on several of the Democratic candidate economic initiatives with us talk about that. Sean, let me start with you as the Republican. What is the thinking here about the president and about other Republican elected officials talking about the Democratic agenda as socialism?
Well, I mean, better this take the canoe down the stream as opposed to trying to paddle up the stream against the current. So Bernie Sanders labels himself a socialist Democrat. AOC does the same. There are other Democrats who are out there giving themselves the label. Why fight the political current when you can just tar your opponents with the names that they're using for themselves and let them define what is a socialist Democrat or whatever it is out there. They're using the word socialist in how they're personally defining themselves. So it's not an easy thing. And it's not, I don't think it's like I've got 16 communist names here in my, coat pocket here. Let your opponents define themselves. And our country is not a really leftist country. It never has been. It generally tends to be a little bit right of center and occasionally tacks back a little bit left of center. So if the Democrats want to define themselves as pretty radical on the social side of the equation, so be it. That just makes it easier for Donald Trump's campaign the next time he's running in 2020.
Professor Heldman, what is the challenge for Democrats in how to respond to that?
I think the challenge is that Donald Trump and Republicans are very actively exploiting the average citizen's lack of knowledge about what a democratic socialist is. A democratic socialist is not a socialist. So if a really easy way to think about it is that power lies in three different areas in society. It lies with political leaders, it lies with corporations, and it lies with people or workers. Socialists want to transfer power from the corporate sphere to political leaders, whereas democratic socialists very clearly want to transfer power from corporations to the people. And actually, this is something that a vast majority of Americans support. So unfortunately, it's simply an issue with labeling. And I think Sean is right that Republicans are exploiting the fact that most Americans just don't know what the label means. I think it would be wise for Democrats to perhaps come up with a better label, since so many Americans are confused about the difference between socialism and democratic socialism.
And how do they do that beyond labels? I mean, do you think it's necessary for the progressive candidates to talk more about capitalism and their support about capitalism, to try and inure against the attacks of being socialists? Beyond labeling, what could they do?
Well, I think focusing on the ideas that they do have to transfer power, more power to workers and to the average person. And I actually think it's a pretty easy thing to sell right now, given that the average tax refund is down 8.7% this year over last year, given the fact that 81% of Americans support the new Green Deal, given the fact that a majority of Americans are concerned about the policies that politicians have passed that have benefited primarily political elites as well as big corporations, given the fact that Amazon pays $0 in federal income tax and they have $11 billion in profit. I actually think that the message resonates quite well. They just need to articulate it as being about the average worker.
Well, and Amazon's a good case because they talk about Amazon and not paying tax and all. But, of course, Amazon's using the tax policies that also benefit far smaller companies as they're trying to get started. Amazon's sort of the outlier here with the remarkable success that it's had. I mean, is it incumbent on Democrats to talk about, well, how would they change the tax structure if they're offended by Amazon not paying taxes?
Well, Larry, this is Sean. They have. So you've got people who say we should have a tax rate that's 70%. And in one case, a new member of the Democratic Congress from Minnesota said it should be 90%. So they're talking about how they think the taxes should be. I'm just not sure that the American public is enthusiastic. They don't mind hitting, I think, a Michael Bloomberg or a Jeff Bezos or a Google Larry Page or Sergey Brin with the high taxes. But, you get down the tax scale pretty fast. In California right now, two-thirds of all of the general fund revenue that goes into the state is paid for by the top 1%. And that's all general fund revenue. And then 50% of that 1% are in that one that revenue. So it's a tiny, tiny portion of people that are paying those taxes. So, there's only so deep you can go into that well until you run out of people. So if you got a tax scheme, you're probably going to have to broaden out your tax scheme as opposed to just, pointing a flashlight at very wealthy people.
Well, that's the challenge California has had because it is so progressive. It's highly volatile tax revenues as a result of that, because wealthy people get so much more of their income from year to year revenue that changes a lot, unlike people who are salaried employees. So are you suggesting that the Democratic proposals at the federal level that could similarly make volatility, or there just aren't enough people? What's
I don't think there's enough people. My head's going to explode, by the way. I'm a classic, typical Republican where I think you need a broader and flatter tax base that spreads out across the country, and you got to spend a heck of a lot less. So, I mean, right now we've got the worst of all worlds. We're spending like drunken sailors, and now we say we want to raise tax rates through the roof to people who actually – not only can Californians leave California and move to Texas and Florida for personal income tax benefits, which I've actually seen people do, but other people can actually move out of the country. And so at some juncture, you can't go to that well all the time, and you've got to get it from two different ways. You've got to expand your tax base, and you've got to cut back on entitlement spending.
We'll continue our conversation with Republican political analyst Sean Walsh, Occidental College Associate Professor of Politics Caroline Heldman. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're talking about Republican use of the term socialism to try and bat back progressive economic proposals that have come from a number of the presidential candidates, as well as from some of the newer, more progressive Democratic members of the House. If you'd like to weigh in on the issue, how successful you think that effort will be or not, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Professor Heldman, what kind of a challenge does this present to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in dealing with these different factions within her party?
Well, it's certainly been a challenge, as you saw at the State of the Union. She's still in charge with one, you know, swing of her hand. She's able to silence a relatively rowdy group of people. I think that it benefits the party in that it's given us, for example, a plethora of presidential candidates, all of whom are attractive in different ways. But it also means that there isn't necessarily a unified message against Donald Trump. It also means that unseasoned members of Congress perhaps have more sway or more of a public voice, and they don't necessarily have the same ability to sway policy or have that power behind the scenes. But this is not—it's not a bad place to be, because the party isn't riven, isn't an all-out war. But as Sean pointed out earlier, there's certainly a more leftist wing of the party that is gaining speed and momentum. And I assume it means for Nancy Pelosi that a lot of the agenda will be pulled to the left.
Sean, your thoughts on what kind of a challenge that it poses for Pelosi as Republicans, you know, of course, have their own challenge, how to respond to President Trump.
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled that Nancy Pelosi, believe it or not, is Speaker. She's going to make Donald Trump's life a living hell, and is right now with all the investigations that are going on in the House. But I will tell you, Larry, I have used in a variety of different states Nancy Pelosi as a vehicle to get members of Congress in the House elected, as well as in Senate campaigns. She has been the single most effective tool for Republicans throughout the country to win elections in many, many states. And so you put Nancy Pelosi front and center, and then you put real activist liberal Democrats running for the White House, and things look relatively good, I think, for Republicans going forward. Donald Trump did not get most of the Republicans elected. They were already elected before he got there. We controlled both the House and the Senate. It was Nancy Pelosi, and the way the Republicans used her as a vehicle to do that did so. So you go, Nancy, you keep – yeah.
Well, I was going to say, what makes her such a boogeywoman with Republicans?
She hails from San Francisco. She hails from a very liberal wing of the party, the whole kind of Burton political machine. And so when she goes out, she raises tons of money, and you raise tons of money historically. She has through the activist parts of the Democratic Party. And so they tend to be a bit liberal, and then these fundraisers show up, and then you see the Barbara Streisands of the world, and then you see some of the other more liberal activists. And so if you're running a race in Kentucky or Tennessee or Mississippi or out in Montana or Wyoming, that's a very effective thing. They don't like San Francisco. They don't like seeing, you know, feces in the streets. They don't like seeing dirty needles in the streets. They don't like seeing the stuff that's projected out of San Francisco's liberalism, and they tie that to Nancy Pelosi. And as I say, Larry, I have used this through various political organizations, or I've used it, but I've been involved in this type of messaging, and it's very, very effective.
So, Caroline, what Sean is describing is, you know, kind of cultural symbolism and what Nancy Pelosi symbolizes. So do you think this is going to be a significant problem for Democrats going forward, or does Trump's unpopularity trump everything?
Well, I think both. And what Sean isn't noting is that her identity as a woman is part of this, too. We saw the rise of high levels of racial resentment and high levels of traditional sexism amongst Trump supporters in 2016. We poll now. We see the same effect. And so it is not happenstance that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a woman of color, her she's become a lightning rod for the right, and in fact, they are propping her up. The left doesn't, I think, quite get why the right is propping her up. They think, oh, it's because she's a young, attractive woman, or she's got these radical ideas. It has a, it's much deeper than that. It actually has to do with who she represents. So AOC and Nancy Pelosi being women means that they receive an extra layer of vitriol in politics from people who are worried about a shifting social order. And so, I think it goes beyond just the policies. It goes to the identity, and it goes to people of color and the penalty for people of color in politics, and the penalty for women in politics, and the biases against them, which make them lightning rods for people who are concerned about women and people of color getting more power in our society.
Sean, you want to respond to that?
Well, I don't know. From my perspective, Nancy Pelosi is, if you look at her age, she is a very, very attractive woman. Physically to look at. She is very, very smart when she speaks. She is dressed very stylishly. So she is very, very appealing to a broad-based, I think, mainstream media. And so she uses her smarts, her good looks, her style to great effect, and then she uses her very, very toughness to keep people in line behind closed doors. So, you know, it works for her with a lot of Democrats, and give her credit. I mean, there was a vast hatred amongst Donald Trump, amongst Democratic activists, and a disgust amongst suburban Republican women. And that's what cost Republicans the Congress this time. She was able to channel that. The question is, can she channel that in the next election cycle, or do we turn the other side of the coin over and we look at Nancy Pelosi, the liberal activist, and San Francisco, you know, social welfare activist? So we'll see. I mean, it's all about branding and how you run a political campaign.
Well, you've said you admire Pelosi politically, even though, you know, you don't share her politics. But I just want to make sure I understand. So are you saying that her polish, her presentation gets her an advantage with media? Is that what you're saying, Sean?
It gets her an advantage with media. It gets her an advantage with high-dollar fundraisers. It gets her an advantage with the Hollywood community. It gets her an advantage with folks that tend to be liberal in the Wall Street community. She's the full package. She's got it all: brains, good looks, smarts, toughness, and she uses all of that to great effect. I think she's dynamite.
Yeah. All right, Caroline, you want to close on that?
I would say that Sean has very deftly turned the question from what Republicans think of her and how they use her to how Democrats use her. And my point was that we have a pretty high resentment in America for power-seeking women, and being a woman in politics many people on the right is you will become a lightning rod simply because of your identity and what it represents to have a woman in that position of power. And so shifting the focus back to what Republicans think of Pelosi, I think there is, in addition to a disdain for her policies, a deep-seated sexism aimed at her and most women, or all women, who are power-seeking in the U.S.
Want to thank you both for being with us. That is Caroline Heldman, Occidental College Associate Professor of Politics, Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, joining us as well. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. A lot more to come in the second hour. I'll tell you about it momentarily. Pleasure to have you with us today on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, email etiquette. When is it okay not to respond to an email, and what is an appropriate length of time by which you need to respond to an email message? We'll talk about that a little bit later this hour. I mentioned last hour about Manny Machado, the Dodgers shortstop for most of last year, reportedly reaching a deal with the Padres for $300 million over 10 years. The Dodgers just announced on their Twitter feed that Don Newcomb, who was a giant in Dodger history, not just for his pitching, but he has been a fixture around that franchise for decades. He passed away after a lengthy illness this morning, the age of 92. Don Newcomb, the Dodger great, passed away. He's someone whose life was an example to so many of the younger players. He had personal challenges that he overcame, dealing with just all kinds of numerous challenges throughout his career to become a truly inspirational figure around the Dodgers. He hadn't pitched with the team since 1960 and was still a fixture everywhere from spring training to Dodger Stadium. So the Dodgers losing a very long time member of their family, Don Newcomb, the Dodger pitcher, and a link to the old Brooklyn Dodgers, dying at the age of 92. Well, I remember when my son was in elementary school, maybe it was middle school, his class went to Riley's Farms up in the San Bernardino Mountain foothills. They do historical reenactments, a beautiful, huge apple farm, one of a number that are up in the Oakland area of San Bernardino County. But the social media postings of John Riley, the owner of Riley's Farms, have led the Claremont Unified School District to pull the plug on its student tours at Riley Farms. And that has John Riley suing the school district for what he says is a violation of his free speech rights. With us is Gustavo Arellano, Los Angeles Times features writer who brought this story to our attention. Gustavo, good morning.
Hola, Larry.
Hola. Gustavo, how did you find out about this lawsuit?
I am a nerd, so I'm always interested in anything that goes on in Southern California, from Cali Mesa down to Costa Mesa. And honestly, I was doing an article for the LA Times about this really good bakery in Cali Mesa, European-style bakery, and I was talking to the people up, you know, it's about 15 minutes away from Oak Glen, and they were telling me, like, oh, yeah, there's one of these farmers, he's suing school districts because they're saying they're, they're infringing on his First Amendment rights. And I thought, what does apples have to do with the First Amendment? I got to check this out.
And so what were the tweets that James Riley posted that led the Claremont School District to stop having students tour there?
Well, what's interesting is that it's not just tweets, and it's not just recent tweets. He has had his own personal blog for years where he has expressed his opinions as a self-professed Christian conservative. So the ones, though, that really got him in trouble came out in 2018, and there was one about making fun about Elizabeth Warren's, what he says is alleged Native American heritage. There was another one saying that he felt that his generation was going to be the last generation to have just two genders. There was another one where he talked about this idea of white supremacy, and he mocked white supremacy. He said white supremacy is dumb. It's, in his opinion, reduced to two guys in Arkansas. But what he felt was more dangerous to the United States was this idea of black supremacy. And he accused Louis Farrakhan and former President Barack Obama and LeBron James of espousing those beliefs.
And so, Claremont, is that the only district that we're aware of that decided not to continue having students come for tours?
So what happened was in September, these parents or one Facebook account in particular, they dredged up these tweets, and all of a sudden social media went crazy. And so you had a lot of parents calling their school district and saying, we demand that you do not allow or you do not take field trips to Oakland, to Riley's Farm, because we don't want to subject our students to whatever's happening there. And so in my story, I didn't get onto the story, but I had parents from Hemet Unified School District who had called their school district mostly in the around the Inland Empire, especially San Bernardino and Riverside counties. None of these school districts would return my calls, but the only one that did, and they declined to comment, was Claremont Unified. They sent a letter to James Riley saying that we're not going to take our students anymore, even though they had a relationship with Riley's Farm for at least 10 years. Never once, according to James Riley, did Claremont Unified have a complaint. And so that's when James Riley decided to sue the school district in federal court.
Gustavo Arellano wrote about this in the Los Angeles Times, the lawsuit from James Riley, the owner of Riley's Farm, against the Claremont Unified School District. With us is the attorney for Mr. Riley, Thomas J. Eastman. Sir, thank you for joining us. Are you there, Thomas Eastman?
I am.
Yes, thank you for joining us. So share with us here how Mr. Riley is claiming that his First Amendment rights are being infringed on by Claremont Unified's decision.
All right. The Constitution has what's called the Unconstitutional Conditions Doctrine, which holds that what government can't do directly, it can't do indirectly either. The issue is not whether a person has a right to a government contract or a government job, but rather that the government has an obligation not to withhold that patronage based on First Amendment considerations.
All right. So, and is there a precedent for making this kind of a civil claim?
Yes. Well, the underlying precedent is called Perry versus Sindeman. That's sort of the seminal unconstitutional conditions doctrine. There are also some additional case law. Umber versus Board of it's a case called Umber and a case called O'Hare versus Northlake, which extends the protections that apply to public employees to public contractors.
All right. Also with us is Pepperdine University School of Law Professor Barry McDonald, who's a First Amendment specialist. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Larry.
Have you heard of a case that closely parallels what James Riley is claiming here?
Not on these specific facts, but certainly in the area of government employees, these kind of disputes arise a lot. You know, courts tend to view government contractors like the farm similar to government employees. When they get in, you know, when they're disciplined or otherwise fired because of what, you know, they may express, and then they sue and say, you violated my First Amendment rights. This would be analogous, a government contractor saying you've terminated me because I've, you know, exercised my free speech rights. And, you know, what courts generally do in these situations is, especially when the government is sort of acting in a special capacity, like as an employer or hiring government contractors, it attempts to do more of a balancing of the government interests against the free speech interests of the speaker. And what the courts generally end up saying is that if the government were forced to affiliate with an employee or a government contractor and their speech was very disruptive or damaging of the mission of the particular government unit involved, then at times the governmental interest can overcome the First Amendment rights of the employee or the government contractor. And in this situation, I think that you could make a good case that, you know, and the Supreme Court has also said that schools have a legitimate interest in teaching children sort of the basic values of civility and civic debate in a democracy. And so I think you could make a good argument that, you know, to force the government to affiliate with a contractor that is, you know, engaging in controversial, offensive remarks of a racist or non-tolerant nature, that schools could reasonably take the position that that would be unduly disruptive or damaging to their educational mission of teaching these sort of basic values of tolerance and respect.
Would it then come down to the court to having to make a determination? Is the content in the social media postings, is it racist? Does it go against accepted norms? Does the court have to decide on that matter?
It doesn't really. It really just needs to look at how controversial and disruptive to the educational mission of the schools the speech is. And, you know, if you're having an uproar at the school, if kids are going to be sort of going to on these field trips focused on, what this controversial things might be said versus, the historical lessons they're trying to be taught, I think a court could take the position that, schools can legitimately be concerned about that sort of disruption to what they want the kids to learn on these sorts of field trips. But on the other hand, I mean, it's not black and white. I mean, I could see a court saying, well, look, tolerance goes both ways, and teaching about our sort of civic rights of free speech, are also important, even if somebody is speaking in a very offensive way that a lot of people disagree with. So it's not black and white. But on the whole, I think I can't see a court saying, well, you have to affiliate with a government contractor that, could be seen as impugning your basic mission.
We're talking with Barry McDonald, Pepperdine University professor of law, Thomas Eastman, attorney representing the owner of Riley Farms, James Riley. Mr. Eastman, you want to respond to that?
Sure. I think there's a major distinction between speech that's spoken in the context of a provider's provision of his services versus speech made on the contractor's own time. If James Riley were putting on a little, Sean Hannity show in knee breeches or making jokes about Stormy Daniels at the field trips, the government's argument might be stronger. Government can control what it says itself. Obviously, if it's paying for a field trip, for a presentation of American history, it has every right to control the content of what it pays for. It's not paying for what the contractor does on its own time, and I would be extremely surprised to find a court saying that, well, you've said things on your own time, so that sort of pollutes everything that you have to say. The kinds of disruption that courts will allow to overcome a contractor's First Amendment rights typically involve things that impair discipline in a workplace or disrupt worker co-relations or a close working relationship. I have not found any cases that suggest that the kind of disruption we're talking about here, where, somebody has said something about a matter of public concern on his own time that doesn't directly involve the provision of the services. We actually had an interesting colloquy with the court in a pretrial hearing where he seemed to be suggesting that the Pickering test, the balancing test that Professor McDonald is talking about, may not even apply. That in this case, independent contractor relationship between Riley's Farm and the schools is so arm's length that the school will have to overcome the much stronger standard that applies when the government is dealing with a private citizen.
Wow.
It'll be interesting to see how that'll turn out. The motion has been under submission, waiting for a ruling from the court for roughly 2 months now.
Have there been other school districts or individual schools that have canceled out unscheduled tours like Claremont Unified?
Yes, there have been. And that's part of the damages we're claiming.
All right. And what percentage of Mr. Riley's income comes from these school tours?
I'm not necessarily at liberty to say that with regard to Mr. Riley. We have said in our complaint that the business of Riley's Farm, the business.
And that's what I meant. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Right. That's roughly half is school tours.
Okay. About half of Riley Farm school tours. So I've been there with my family on a weekend. It was packed, even aside from school tours. So I know they do their business in just a few weeks, but obviously a very popular place. Barry McDonald of Pepperdine, quick closing thought on the potential that it wouldn't be this balancing, this weighing of the Pickering test, but instead the free speech of a typical citizen would be the standard here?
Well, I would point to a decision of the Supreme Court called Brough versus City of San Diego, where there you had a off-duty San Diego police officer making porn videos on his own. And when the police department found out about it, they fired him and he sued for violating his free speech rights, saying, hey, this was off off government time. The Supreme Court accepted that, but they said still the government acting as employer had sufficient interest involved in, you know, one of their police officers not making these porn videos. And while I forget the farmer's name.
James Riley.
He's obviously not making porn videos. He is engaging in what courts would deem to be commentary about issues of public concern. But still, that case sets a precedent to say that the government's interests don't just sort of stay within the school or stay within the workplace. They can extend out of that. And if, you know, an employer or contractor is creating problems outside for the, you know, the mission of the government within the confines of the workplace or school, then you still get into that sort of balancing analysis, which the court did in that case. And they ruled that the city of San Diego Police Department was justified in firing him.
I want to thank you both for being with us. We're talking with Barry McDonald, Pepperdine University professor, and Thomas J. Eastman, who's the attorney representing James Riley, the owner of Riley Farms in Oak Glen, the beautiful San Bernardino Mountain foothill community. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, how in the so-called gig economy, workers are finding ways to fight back against the platforms they use for their employment. We'll talk about some of the concessions that they've been able to get back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Fresh Air with Terry Gross today featuring Andrew McCabe. He was the acting FBI director after James Comey's firing. Then he was fired by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Of course, has new memoir out. He talks with Terry coming up at noon today. Well, if you are a worker in the so-called gig economy, you might feel like there's really no boss to complain to. If you don't like your compensation or you don't like working conditions. But Carolyn Said, who writes about the gig economy for the San Francisco Chronicle, has a recent piece about how employees in the gig economy have been able to make some significant inroads when it comes to how tips are handled, when it comes to compensation and the like. And there have been some recent court decisions, such as by the California Supreme Court, which also potentially benefit workers in the gig economy. Caroline, it's good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
So let's start, first of all, with tips. I know this is one of the most controversial areas. You write about some of these platforms that actually just took the money that customers tipped to the employee and just put it against the minimum wage for the worker.
That's right. But minimum wage is a misnomer. These platforms do not guarantee minimum wage. They put it against the base pay they provide the workers. But again, these workers are not necessarily even making minimum wage. And the companies would insist with a straight face, well, we're passing 100% of the tips onto workers and then ignore the fact that what they actually paid, the underlying payment, was subsidized by those tips. The most famous case that went viral was a man who delivered groceries for Instacart. Maybe it took him an hour. He made $10.80. Of that, $10 came from the tip. 80 cents came from Instacart.
And what would have that base pay been? Let's say the customer didn't tip a thing. What would his base pay have been?
It was guaranteed a base pay of $10.
Okay. So it would have been essentially, you made an 80-cent tip, essentially, it sounds like.
Right. Well, he should have made $20, the $10.
Yeah, on top of that.
Or tip.
So how are employees, given that, you know, they don't have a union, they don't...
Right. And again, I'm sorry, Larry, to correct you, but they are not employees. They are independent contractors. That's a very important point to note. Sorry.
No, that's right. I appreciate the I was using the term too loosely. Yes. I'm glad you're being accurate. So for those working under these platforms, what are the ways that they are coming together to fight back against the pay practices of the platforms?
So they're coming together on the same internet that enables these platforms to operate. They're getting together on Facebook and Reddit. They're forming forums. They're complaining to each other. And it started with just that, you know, complaining, venting, venting grievances to each other, and that itself didn't go that far. But then they got even more organized. In the case of Instacart workers, they joined forces with a union-affiliated group called Working Washington, which did help move them to the next level of organization, I would say. They started an online petition. They got thousands of signatures. They made a concerted effort to make sure that customers knew that their tips were not going to the workers as a reward for good service, but were being taken by this multi-billion dollar company to help subsidize what it paid them. That was one, you know, very recent and very striking example. And Instacart did capitulate. It did turn around its policy. It did say, all right, from now on, we promise that the tips will be on
tips or tips.
We pay, and that we will also pay back pay to people whose tips were used in this way.
You know, it's because I haven't been certain about how tips actually get to the worker. I'll often ask, well, would you rather me tip in the app or give you cash? And typically I say, oh, cash, please, because right. I guess for that very reason.
In advance in the app, the company knows about that and can apply it. And Instacart is not the only company with this policy. Both DoorDash and Amazon Flex have a similar policy, and they have not altered it yet. So those might be future campaigns coming from those workers to organize.
I would love to hear from you if you're someone who is a driver, you work in the gig economy, you do deliveries, you work for Uber or for Lyft. What are some of the ways, if you have, that you have advocated with fellow workers who work with these platforms to try and bring about changes? We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Now, how does last year's California State Supreme Court ruling about independent contractors play into this, Carolyn?
So that is a massive underlying thread here. We don't know yet what will happen exactly. So that Supreme Court ruling in the case of, I believe it's pronounced Dynamics, a delivery company, said that the drivers for that company were employees using a very simple test of three parts, A, B, C, which was, you know, were they controlled by the company they worked for? Did they have their own independent businesses doing this work? And were they doing work that was within the primary scope of the company's business? So under that very simple test, many, many people such as Uber and Lyft drivers could get reclassified as employees, which is something the companies don't want. So Dynamax hasn't yet really resulted in any wide-scale changes. It's been cited in a few lawsuits. But now, in terms of wide-scale changes in the California legislature, they are looking at, they're thrashing out right now a bill that would either enshrine or limit the Dynamax decision. So there are feverish negotiations going on in Sacramento between unions, between gig companies, and between lawmakers about what's the next step. And what the gig companies would like to do is to maintain these workers as independent contractors, but what they're offering as a give back is to help them have some kind of flexible benefits. You know, that one of the big things that you don't get when you're an independent contractor are, you know, unemployment insurance, sick leave, vacation time, you know, a whole, you know, raft of, you know, retirement accounts, a whole raft of benefits. And the gig companies are willing to dig into their pockets to a certain extent to enable that, as long as it comes with a guarantee that they can keep those workers as independent contractors.
We're talking with San Francisco Chronicle reporter Carolyn Saeed. She specializes in writing about the on-demand economy as well as business and tech. Her recent piece, Revolt of the Gig Workers, How Delivery Rage Reached a Tipping Point, was by Instacart drivers going straight to the customers and telling them that the tips were not on top of the base pay that the delivery drivers were getting. It was going against their base pay, so they really weren't seeing a premium at all. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Ian in Lakewood, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, you drive for Lyft, I understand?
Yes, I do.
And do you have much contact with other drivers about stuff that you feedback you want to give the company?
Yeah, our only chance to talk to other drivers often is times when we're waiting at LAX for rides. When we're in the parking lot together, we get together and talk about our routes, about our income, which times our best to work, but we have no base pay per hour of motivation to go out and work for an hour without getting enough rides to make a minimum wage.
And so you might be aware that in New York, there is a base pay of $17.22 an hour after expenses for Uber and Lyft drivers. Carolyn, you want to comment on what changes that New York law has brought?
Yeah, that is a massive change. That's the first place in the country that guarantees a minimum wage for Uber and Lyft drivers. And, it could be precedent setting. New York is a very different taxi hired car market than the rest of the country, and has a long established history of labor organizing among them. And New York has a quasi labor organization called the Independent Drivers Guild that led the campaign to get that minimum wage. So the companies do have to supplement. If you had a shift where you just had one fare for $10 and you were in New York, the companies would have to give you another $7, or actually more than that, because they're giving you that money after expenses.
Let's talk with Al in Irvine. You're on Air Talk. You work for DoorDash, I understand?
Yes, that's correct. I'm actually on an order right now.
Oh, good. Don't let the food get cold, but go ahead.
So my biggest problem with DoorDash is you're not able to reach out to the customer service unless you're on an order. They don't have a direct line when you're off to reach out. They also have what's known as peak pay, so certain hours of the day they promise extra money on top of the guarantee that you're given. However, there's a design flaw in the app that if you want to go offline and it's very busy, you're not able to do so. And if an order comes in, you're forced to reassign, which lowers your acceptance rating, and you must have an acceptance rating of 80% or higher in order to get this peak pay. This has happened to me on several occasions, as well as with other drivers on forums like Reddit and Facebook. And I don't see DoorDash really doing anything to help the drivers working for their platform.
Al, I appreciate you sharing your experience as a DoorDash driver. Carolyn Said, you want to respond to some of the points he raises?
I think what Al said kind of encapsulates how these platforms work. The workers are not reporting to a human being that they can talk to. They're reporting to faceless software subroutines, to algorithms. And the algorithms are not designed for worker happiness. They're designed for customer happiness and for maximizing profit. So the peak times that Al was talking about, they need to get more people delivering at lunch and at dinner, and so they will pay a little bit more, but they're also penalizing the workers if they're not available or they're not taking enough orders during that time. And the workers don't really have a recourse to say this isn't okay with me, other than just not working at all.
Brad, in Studio City, you used to drive for Instacart, I understand. So did you have any involvement in this campaign against the company?
Yeah, I actually, I drove for a little bit, and for a while I wondered why I wasn't getting tips on orders. And then the more I talked to other shoppers at grocery stores, it turned out there was, this big underground movement kind of where I was kind of filled in on exactly what was going on. I was shocked. I had no idea about it. And their solution to it was, we had these printed out flyers explaining exactly what's happening and exactly how the customer could, tip us accordingly. And the fact that, these service fees were not mandatory and that they had to change them. So it was a very detailed thing that they would drop in the bags, actually, or they'd end up talking to the customer about. So I thought it was really fascinating. And I found even some customers would ask me about tips when I got there. They said, other people said it's better to tip in cash. And I'm like, I don't really understand why, but I'm like, whatever works for you. So and I would, take a jump. And
yeah. So beyond telling, though, customers we'd appreciate a cash tip, what more could customers do?
I believe that they could waive the service fee and then add the tip via the app, but that's pretty much it. It was two extra steps, I want to say.
Yeah.
I know that in this type of industry, it's like people just want their stuff. They don't want to complicate things. So I think, I dealt with a few people, familiar names, which I can't name probably. I don't want to get.
Yeah, please don't.
But and I'd be surprised at these huge orders, like $400 orders, you know, carts like full of stuff and no tip. And I'm just like, what in the world? And I like to think that people just didn't realize that this service fee that people thought this was going to the drivers.
Yeah, I wouldn't have known till I read Carolyn's article. Brad, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Carolyn Saeed, thank you so much for talking with us about another fascinating part of the on-demand economy. Thanks very much.
For having me.
Carolyn Saeed writes for the San Francisco Chronicle. Coming up, we'll talk about email etiquette. Really, are you required to respond to every email that comes from a real person or not? Is email less formal than that? We'll talk about it after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. Hedy was just talking about the death of longtime television consumer reporter David Horowitz. He had the syndicated show Fight Back as well. But if you were living in Southern California back in the mid-'80s, you might remember the night in 1987. It was August 19th when somehow a guy got onto the lot at NBC4's Burbank Studios, got into the live news studio while Horowitz was on the air. And the man said that he had a gun, that he was holding it at Horowitz. Horowitz, this is live on television, was incredibly calm and composed. I'm being told that there's a gun at my... And he just went through the whole thing. Finally, it turned out it was a BB gun. It was not actually a handgun. But I'll never forget that, how calm under that kind of pressure David Horowitz was in that incident. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. And we turn our attention to email and what we need to think of in terms of our obligation to respond to it. I have friends who respond to every single email that they receive. You know, that's not spam. That's not some sort of solicitation. But any personal email is very promptly responded to. Others who, you know, it's kind of the roll of the dice whether you're going to get a response or not. With us from the Wharton School of Business at Penn, organizational psychologist Adam Grant, who just wrote a recent New York Times essay, "No, you can't ignore email. It's rude." Adam, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Larry. Glad to be here.
So, share with us your view on this. Why do you think it's important that we treat email generally in the same way we would have an old, you know, postal service mailing or a phone call?
Well, I think rudeness aside, there's a growing body of evidence that your responsiveness is actually a pretty important driver of your job performance. So there was a major study that just came out at Microsoft where if you look at all the different things that managers do online, the clearest warning signal that a manager is ineffective is being slow to answer emails, or worse yet, not answering them at all. You know, if you're an employee and you have a boss who doesn't respond, it's really hard to do a good job. And so I worry a lot that when people say, you know, I'm just overwhelmed with email, I ignore it, that they're actually letting their colleagues and their employees down.
Well, and is it a proxy for not being as attentive in other areas, do you think, that people can be perfectly attentive in every other area but just hit and miss responsive on email?
That happens sometimes. Look, we all have a medium where we're not good at responding, right? I'm terrible at text messages, but very fast on email generally. But there is evidence that people who are disorganized in one domain are also more likely to be disorganized in another. And the personality trait behind this is often called conscientiousness. So you'll know the conscientious people as the ones who sometimes fire back a response before you've even hit send.
Seems like they read your mind.
And, you know, they tend to show those habits in meetings. You see it, you know, in email responses. And that's just a discipline that they bring with them to most tasks that are important to them.
Well, I'd love to hear from you as an AirTalk listener. What are your rules for responding to email? What's your intent? What do you actually do? How quickly do you respond to email, and how variable is that? 866-893-KPCC. And just as importantly, what are your expectations for others to respond to an email message? 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. I say for myself when it comes to email that the importance of the message dictates how quickly I'm going to respond to it. If I get an email from a member of our team in the morning before we go on the air regarding today's show, obviously it's an immediate response. If I get an email from my father asking a question about something that, you know, there's really no time deadline for it, I may not get back to him for 24 hours. Another, you know, question from a family member that's really pressing, I'll get back fast. But how do you deal with it? 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Lisa in Pacific Palisades emailed us and said, I think if someone close or a business associate, that the minimum response means that you need to acknowledge the email's been received or a note you'll write back when you have a moment to be thoughtful. That's just the polite thing to do. Etiquette is about being polite. That's Lisa on email. And yes, we responded to her promptly. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Carrie writes on the page, I'm an obsessive email checker, if you will, as it plays a significant role in my job as an outside sales representative. While there are many emails that do require immediate response and attention, I generally find my inbox flooded with FYI messages from employees in the office or marketing. With those types, I don't feel the need to respond with a thank you or received. 866-893-KPCC. Jean in Pasadena said, I think it varies generationally as well as if it's a personal or professional email. Adam Grant, you want to speak to the generational issue? Does the age of the emailer or recipient make a difference?
Yeah, I still get emails in all caps from my grandma, which is delightful.
She's yelling at you, you know.
On the other hand, very often I notice that they'll just never respond to emails. But on text, it's just like you beamed a message right to their brain. And so the medium might carry different expectations. And look, I'm not saying you should have to answer every email at all, right? I don't want anyone to be a slave to their inbox. But I also think that just ghosting people altogether is a great way to show that you're either disorganized or you just don't care.
One of the challenges I've had is it seemed like early on, texts were used by people for something that was more urgently needing a response, and email was often not at that level of urgency. But now as more and more people text, particularly younger people, and rarely email, it seems like text doesn't have the same urgency it used to. Have you noticed that?
I have, and I think also it ends up actually slowing you down, because if you're dealing with hundreds of text messages and they're not immediately connected to your computer, I don't know that many people who can type as quickly on an iPhone as they can on a keyboard.
Yeah, very good point. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Gretchen in West Covina, welcome.
Thank you. I would like to say I don't do email now, but when I was working and it was for a government entity, if I got an email, how I would respond most of the time is just pick up the phone and call them back. I worked with clientele who did not have access to email or had very limited resources monetarily, and I consider myself now and then as a very conscientious person, and it worked well. The main people I did email when I was working was with the universities, because their time schedules were just off the beam in terms.
All right. Gretchen, I appreciate it. You're one of those few people not on email right now. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Alex in Topanga Canyon, your thoughts on how you handle email.
I believe that for me personally, I have to respond the same way. Not only it's the right thing to do, it keeps the business flowing, but it's also kind of the expectation for the employee because there's repercussions if you don't. And I, typically have the same expectations, or I believe that there should be the same expectations for the manager as well. Doesn't happen all the time, and when it doesn't, it makes me feel unvalued, or it just feels that it simply is unfair because there's not a whole lot of repercussions for the management, where there are plenty of repercussions for somebody that's just...
So how quickly do you expect a reply, Alex?
I think if it's the same or at least the following business day, I think that is something that should be expected. But oftentimes, if it doesn't happen for a week, I feel that I'm either being forgotten about or perhaps they've never seen my email, which is often the case.
All right, Alex. Thanks. Alex in Topanga Canyon. We'll continue with Adam Grant, Penn University Wharton School of Business, organizational psychologist, with a really interesting op-ed in the New York Times. No, you can't ignore email. It's rude. Hear what your rules are, as well as your expectation for email, back in 1 minute. Adam Grant's our guest from Penn's Wharton School of Business, organizational psychologist. Hey, Adam, what is your expectation for timeliness of response on email?
Oh, I think that totally depends on who you're emailing with and what the norms of your workplace are. I think it's crazy to expect anyone to respond right away. And I'm a big fan of some of the organizations that have said, you know what, we actually ask people to ban emails on nights and weekends.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of places are taking that on. Let's talk next with David in Costa Mesa. David, what are your expectations and practices with email?
Well, this is a story when I was a senior executive at Ingram Micro. I was getting complaints about one of my vice presidents not being responsive. And so I confronted him and asked to look at his Outlook, and he had 2,000 unread emails, which was an indication not just of rudeness, but ineffective managerial behavior. I gave him an objective of having 0 unread emails within 10 business days, which he did. He was a little grumpy about it, but it needed that kind of dramatic confrontation.
Wow. David, thanks so much. Our AirTalk producing staff have thousands of unread emails, each of them. I have 0 unread emails. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Nick in Hollywood, your practices and expectations on email.
Yes. You know, Larry, I own a retail store, and I get about 20 to 25 emails a day, and it's people looking to sell things. And with me, it becomes a kindness issue. Sometimes people will send me pictures that I think, oh, my God, they are trying to keep food on the table by what they're selling. And I call them right away because I can see the urgency. Usually I don't buy, but I'll try to make recommendations where they will sell things. And then I find myself dragging a little bit. If I see things worth thousands of dollars, I'll call the next day because these people evidently have money and there's no urgency there. So with me, it's a kindness issue of helping somebody.
Nick, I appreciate it very much. And even though you don't get a lot of emails, obviously each one is potentially important to your business. And then you've got other folks. I'm in this category where I get hundreds of emails a day. But most of them are not things that I need to respond to. They're pitches or, you know, things like that. Yours are pretty much, they're all important ones that you need to deal with. Let's talk next with Dan in Culver City. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Go ahead, please.
I think email in most organizations is abused because people who run the organizations haven't really analyzed the flow of messages. It's one thing if you're in an outward-facing position like customer service, but typically those emails don't go to an individual. They go to some sort of shared mailbox or some system so that it's not trapped in one person's message bin. But internally, within my organization, for example, we use an incident tracking system or an issue tracking system so that we don't fill up our email with stuff and we have an accountable way of keeping track of the status of issues.
Yeah, that's interesting, Dan. And there are all these ways of managing email that, you know, now Outlook has the focused inbox versus the other. And Adam Grant, how do you think these filters affect the way people think of email?
Well, I think we're going to see more and more companies moving to tools like Slack, which say, look, you know, instead of everybody having their own personal inbox for all issues, there are some items that are better addressed on a channel where everybody who's interested in that topic or working on that project can go into the channel. And I think that's a much more efficient mechanism than just trying to create endless email filters.
Yeah, we use Slack here as well. So you have to follow Slack and email, and there are multiple Slack channels depending on, you know, different shows and different work groups and things like that. There's so much for people to follow now when it comes to communications. Dan, I appreciate it very much. Mary Louise in Irvine, I understand you teach business writing at UCI. What do you tell your students about email?
Hi. Yes, I do. I've been doing it for about 15 years, and I teach engineers and just a whole array of professionals. And I tell them that email, although it wasn't designed to manage our workload, it was really not designed as that kind of a tool. But I absolutely tell them that it's the only way to create rapport if that's the only way that you interact with people. And if that's what you have, it needs to be maximized. I try to have them get a back and forth rhythm going and then maybe take up the phone to create rapport. That's really what you want to do. I also want to tell a quick story that I tell in my classes.
Yeah.
About Dax Shepard and Mark Maron. And Mark Maron, established podcaster, received an email, polite, from Dax Shepard asking to be on his show. Mark Maron did not acknowledge the email. Dax Shepard goes on to get his own show, and when Mark Maron went to text him and say, hey, man, how come you haven't responded to me to be on my podcast? Dax Shepard said, I sent you an email. You didn't respond to it. It's a great story, and I use it often.
I love it. Mary Louise, thanks. Thanks so much. Teaches business writing at UC Irvine. Lucas in Huntington Beach. I'm getting short on time, but quickly. I understand you're a millennial. How do you deal with this based on the age of the person?
Well, it totally depends on how old they are. If there's someone who I know is in my millennial age group, I often see in my age group multiple unread emails on my friends' phones, and I just cannot stand that personally. So I just make sure that I text them. If I'm in a group with a bunch of people, I make a group text. However, if I'm trying to be more professional with a boss or someone who I know is older than me, or just someone like an adult who's a friend of mine who's older than me and trying to seem in a professional setting, I will 100% send them an email, a group email if need be, because I just find that it gives more of a professional atmosphere to my question or concern.
I appreciate it, Lucas. Thanks for your call. And Adam Grant, you also write about some people who strictly enforced email hours where maybe a couple times in the day that they just set aside time to do email. That can work for some people.
Yeah, I think we all need to set boundaries. And the key to setting them is actually communicating them. So, you know, you can treat it a little bit like office hours. Let people know you check email at 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. every day. And otherwise, you're going to be doing focus work in between. And people are pretty adaptable to that unless you have a job where responsiveness is a key part of your momentary existence.
Adam Grant, thanks so much for being with us. We sure appreciate it. He hosts the TED podcast, Work Life. He's an organizational psychologist at Wharton at Penn. Have a great afternoon from all of us at Air Talk. Fresh Air with Terry Gross, guest Andrew McCabe, coming right up here on 89.3.